Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Be sure to stick around for a rundown of the latest stories happening here in the Chicago area at the very end of this podcast. Now, let's turn to the conversation you clicked on. When marginalized communities are under attack, who shows up? For Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander Heritage Month, we've been looking at what solidarity really looks like, not just in theory, but in action. From protests to coalition building, more activists are leaning into intersectional solidarity. That's the idea that different communities can fight for each other's rights and struggles together. But building these relationships isn't always easy. So, how do people move past tension, misunderstanding, or silence to create real support? In this episode of the pod, we'll hear from a panel of community leaders about lessons that they've learned and how showing up for others can strengthen everyone. At the table was Nubia Bautista Willman, who's Chief Programs Officer of Latinos Progresando, Danae Kovac, who's Executive Director of the HANA Center, and Reverend Jamie Fluker, who's Executive Director of Southsiders Organized for Unity and Liberation, or SOUL. We started with a peek into each organization. Which communities do they serve? What services do they offer? Danae went first.
So HANA Center, we are an immigrant justice organization headquartered in Albany Park and also working in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. And we provide critical social services for low-income, limited English-speaking immigrants. And we integrate that with civic engagement and community organizing to push for social and structural change. We are founded in and deeply rooted in the Korean-American community here, but we've also expanded to provide services for Spanish-speaking immigrants and other multi-immigrants in the area as well.
Nice. And Reverend Jamie?
Hi, I am the executive director of SOUL. We are a Southside and Chicagoland, South suburban, grassroots, multi-issued, faith-based organization. So here at SOUL, we believe that we put our faith on the front lines of injustice. A part of the work that we do at SOUL, we are in communities, primarily the West Pullman and Roseland area is essentially where we drop our anchor. Mm-hmm. But we're doing things from working in community on issues related to decarceration, working on issues related to water justice. We're entering into the world of data centers and working on that as well. And so anything that our communities are letting us know are an issue are the things that we put our time, effort, and energy into.
It's funny you say you're entering into the world of data centers. They're coming here. So you've had no choice but to jump into that.
They're already here.
They're already here. Nubia.
Hi, thank you for having me. So Latinos Progresando is a nonprofit that's based in Marshall Square Little Village. We're 28 years old, and we provide legal services, community programs, community investment to the residents of Marshall Square, as well as advocacy. Our mission is to elevate the well-being of the Mexican community, but we build bridges with all other types of cultures and communities as well.
What does solidarity mean to you, Nubia?
That's a good question. Really, for me, it's sort of twofold. It's the work that we do to make sure that we're inclusive and including other perspectives and people. And then when we're thinking about the type of advocacy we do, we think about who's at the table, who's missing. Even as a nonprofit, right, we have the power to make those types of decisions and develop those types of the type of work and partnerships. Mm-hmm. And then also the other part is just individually. I think we are some very sort of in our own cocoon, in our own neighborhoods, it's really sometimes easy just to stay in the space where you're working and living. And so making that decision to go outside of those spaces, to even think about your own friend groups, what you look like, where you go, to make sure it's as inclusive as possible.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Jamie?
Yeah, for us, I think, and even personally, solidarity for us as a power-building organization, it takes all of us. We define power as organized people and organized money. We find that often that we don't do anything. There's nothing that we do that is individualized, that everything that we do has an impact. It's thinking about it from this perspective. If I took a rock and threw it into a river or threw it to a body of water, how it ripples. I think about solidarity as this. These are the rippling effects of the things that we're working towards. So the collective doesn't really win anything unless the collective is actually a collective and is working together around issues.
Danae, why is it important for solidarity to be intersectional?
Yeah, so I think an important aspect of solidarity recognizes that we're not the same. We are different, and that that diversity is a strength. And like Reverend Jamie was saying, having that diversity coming together, bringing those different perspectives, experience, skills, is what makes our collective stronger. And it recognizes that as individuals and as communities, we have many different aspects. So I'm Asian American, I'm Korean American, but I'm also a woman, I'm a millennial, I'm an adoptee. I bring all of that to the work that we do, not only within our own community, but when we work with other communities.
So what are some of the barriers you would say to maintaining intersectional solidarity? Because it's not easy.
It's not. It's hard, right? That's the reality. It's hard, and it has to be intentional work. We have to intentionally work at that to understand ourselves and to intentionally reach out and to be in proximity and understand one another. And the unfortunate reality is that this society is set up in such a way to keep groups competing for scraps. It's really white supremacy that has set it up this way. And you know, keeps people thinking that, oh, only this little thing is what I can have. And if someone else has something, that means I have to give it up. And that's just false. And that keeps us competing with each other when we should be coming together instead.
Nubia, Chicago is so segregated.
That is true.
Such a segregated city, you know, and communities are often, you know, working within themselves. And it can be difficult, I think, to be less siloed.
Yes.
Talk about that.
No, that's so accurate. I think
is that a reality for your group? Is that a conversation that comes up?
It is. And I think we really look at what, how we can view a power as a collective. We obviously focus on the Mexican community. The neighborhood we live in is majority Mexican, but we recognize that there is a diaspora, that things are shifting, that we there is power in a collective. And so it's important to be able to build those bridges with people. And as Danae mentioned, like it's important for us to really think about it with intention so that when we're building coalitions and we're building this power, we're able to do it together.
Yeah. And I'm going to bring up the elephant in the room, right? You know, we're all obviously people of from marginalized communities here. And each of our groups growing up or just even in adulthood, we've got biases and stereotypes about other groups that we have had to unlearn over time, right? We're all nodding here at the table. So talk to me about like that reality. How do you move past what you've been taught about other groups? How do you continue to address some negative assumptions that people within your group may have about others and try to be that bigger person and say, well, that's not how it is and we should come together. What does that look like, Reverend Jamie?
You know, it is, you know, going back to Chicago being such a segregated city, it is actually, you know, all the different cultures that are here. And folks, we love it. You think about the things that we identify with. Like, you can go to any country in this city and eat. And it's good.
Yeah. Right?
And we love that. But at the same time, when you think about, like, what kind of divides and what keeps us, we don't know one another's stories.
We don't.
We don't know. And the relationship building around, we know a story that's been told to us, a dominant narrative about each of us, but we don't know one another's stories.
And then are we any better than others who may look at all of our groups of color and think something? Do you know what I mean? Like, are we any more progressive than the folks who are on the other side of the table?
Sometimes we aren't.
Yeah.
Not as progressive as we think we are. And a part of that cause is because we don't pause to even think about and also analyze what we do and how we arrived at a space and place, which is an important part. We're asking others to do that, and that's a critique we often have. But it's also not that we don't actually take that as a critique of our own self, amongst ourselves, to say, let me pause and think, where did this come from?
And where did I hear this?
Where did I hear this? Who told this?
Is there any truth to this?
And why am I believing it?
Have I even seen it happen?
Absolutely.
Yeah. What? Where do we start, Danae, to even address some of these barriers?
Yeah, so I would love to share an example from Hannah Center. So back in 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, and, you know, we were seeing the racial uprising in this country, we had second generation Korean Americans. So those who were born here, but their parents immigrated from Korea, come to Hannah Center and say, we need your help. Our parents are saying some really racist, some really anti-Black things. And we need to figure out how we can talk with them about this, how we can educate them. And so we went on a listening tour of the community to really hear from first-generation Korean immigrants and also second-generation children to understand kind of what, you know, they were dealing with. in the racial uprising. And out of that, a community group formed called Kabuki Hakyo, which in Korea means school of turtles, this really intentional idea that we need to go slowly in this, but also an intentional commitment to recognizing and unlearning anti-blackness, because we do see that in our own community. And there are historical things that have happened that we need to acknowledge. And so it's been this journey for the past 6 years that this group has been going on. And from that, they then brought out public education programs, which we've been calling People's Academy, which is an intentional intergenerational multilingual Korean English space where people can come together, talk about, you know, what did I learn growing up? Where did I hear this? Why do I think this? What are the stereotypes? And what can I learn and who can I hear from that can challenge that and help me to grow?
So we're having this conversation. It's AANHPI month. Of course, this work happens beyond me, right? And should be happening beyond just 1 month. So tell me, Danae, some of the most pressing issues right now that the Asian American community is struggling with, knowing that it's not a monolith, right?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for acknowledging that.
What's hard right now?
Yeah. Asian American community is so diverse in the U.S. We are the only racial group that is still majority immigrant in this country. And of the 11 undocumented immigrants in this country, 2 million are Asian and 1 million are Black. And so all of the things that we see and hear about in the news impacting immigrant communities are impacting us. The very anti-immigrant enforcement actions, the policy changes, the gutting that we see at USCIS and things like that are definitely impacting our community. We also are continuing to see the impacts of anti-Asian hate and violence that has not gone away, although maybe it's not as reported anymore.
People thought it went away with COVID.
Exactly. It's not. It's still happening.
And COVID's still happening.
Exactly.
Let's be clear about that, too.
Yeah, health concerns as well. And then just, you know, greater concerns about rising costs and affordability that are impacting many communities also continue to impact Asian American communities, especially small business owners.
Nubia, talk to me about where you see some overlap in what Danae just described. You've talked about how immigration is often seen as this very specific Latino issue.
Yes.
And she's saying it's not.
It's not. No, that's absolutely correct. And I think that's important. There is a, it's important to see where we have similarities in order to build that solidarity. And in the immigration space specifically, immigration law often has stemmed from an Asian experience. The first immigration law, which is the Chinese Exclusion Act, which prohibited Chinese people from coming to the United States. And then we think about the 70s when we had a labor shortage. And so we brought in South Asian medical professionals because the United States needed them as workers. And then we even think about here in Chicago, the first dreamer was a Korean woman. But yet, you know, we think about immigration, it's a Latino issue, and it absolutely is, but it's also impacting so many other communities. Mm-hmm. And it's important for us to know that history, because the more we realize that we have these similarities and difficulties, that with these similar barriers, we can work on tumbling them down together.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And Reverend Jamie, this impacts the Black community too.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely does.
Right?
It goes back to like the storytelling, the narrative building, like around what has been said about us that's not true. You think about even the issues that are intersectional that we all deal with. You know, Audre Lorde said there's no single issue struggle because we don't live single issue lives.
Mm.
And so things that from housing to access to resources to even being seen as not a first class citizen, but a second class citizen are what many of the folks in our marginalized communities are feeling.
Mm-hmm. So what does having all of these shared struggles signal to you? Reverend Jamie?
It signals to me that there's collective power to be built here.
Yeah.
That no one thing is impacting just a single community or a single demographic, that these are all things that are impacting all of us.
Yeah.
And if it's kind of the you know, Fannie Lou Hamer said, you know, when I liberate myself, I'm liberating others. So instead of us just thinking about it from one perspective that we're looking at this, it's multidimensional, but it impacts all of us.
We could talk about this all day, but as we start to wrap, I would love to hear from everybody at the table. Think about the folks listening to us right now. How do we all start showing up for one another? What's your advice? Mm-hmm. Nubia?
There's so many big and small ways to do it. I think if you're thinking just like, what can I do today? Think about breaking outside of your neighborhood cocoon and going and helping support a small business, a place in a neighborhood you've never been to. Mm. I think that's just really a small way for you to start building that sort of muscle. And then on the bigger scale, thinking again, the tables that you're building, who are you bringing? Who are you inviting? Who can you go and you know, do a peace offering to say, let's work together.
Yeah, no, that's so big. There are so many people that have not been to certain sections of this city. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of wild when you think about it, like lifelong Chicagoans who haven't been here or haven't been there. Danae.
Yeah, I would really echo that. I think it does start with the individual being open and taking that intentionality to try to go outside of yourself and your community and educate yourself. There's lots of great memoirs you can read from different perspectives, lots of great small businesses you can support, organizations that you can support to get involved with the work that they're doing. And then it does go beyond that. You know, solidarity requires that we acknowledge the systemic and structural barriers that need to be addressed and need to be changed. And we can do that through organizing and community power building and advocacy.
Mm-hmm. And Reverend Jamie, last word to you.
As the organizer, I'm going to say it's all about relationships. Who haven't you spoken to? Whose story that you don't know? And whose story needs to hear, who needs to hear your story? The opportunity to reach outside of looking at what our own self-interests are, finding someone who has a mutual shared interest, and let's work together and fight together.
It's a great place to leave it. Reverend Jamie Fluker is Executive Director of Southsiders Organized for Unity and Liberation, or SOUL. Nubia Batista-Wilman is Chief Programs Officer of Latinos Progresando. And Danae Kovac is Executive Director of the HANA Center. Thank you, ladies. Great work.
Thanks for
having
us.
Thank you so much.
Turn to the top stories of the day in Chicago and Illinois. We checked in with WBEZ Midday anchor Lisa Labas, WBEZ education reporter Sarah Karp, and WBEZ senior editor of arts and culture Cassie Walker Burke. We were also joined by WBEZ city government and politics reporter Mariah Wolfel, who's over in Rome reporting on Mayor Brandon Johnson's trip to meet the Pope. Now, as we spoke, Johnson was inside meeting with the pontiff, and Mariah was standing outside. Here she is with a preview of what's on Johnson's agenda.
Yeah, he got here earlier this morning, and there was a bit of a frenzy just now because he arrived to the Vatican a little bit earlier than everyone expected with an entourage of maybe 15 black vans. And he went into the Vatican through a security entrance for his meeting with the Pope. And this entourage included civic leaders, business leaders, religious leaders, a rabbi, a bishop, Alderman Jason Irvin. Apparently Stacey Davis Gates, CTU president, was also part of this entourage. And they will all go, they are all inside right now. Presumably, Johnson might be in his one-on-one meeting with the Pope right now. And the rest of the entourage will get to meet the Pope afterwards and shake hands with him.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so that is quite the delegation. More folks than we definitely expected to accompany the mayor. So they'll all sort of have an audience with the Holy See then?
Right. So the mayor will have his one-on-one meeting. And, you know, we've been talking about what he's going to discuss in that meeting. He might discuss the encyclical that the Pope released this week on the church's perspective, warning about the dangers of AI, artificial intelligence, and how that could affect humanity. Johnson said he wants to talk about that. He wants to talk about their shared experience of being slammed by the Trump administration on Truth Social. You know, Johnson, just as recently as this week, was getting slammed by the president. So those are some of the things he might talk about. Johnson is not giving the Pope a Cubs hat.
Yes.
He joked about it repeatedly. Not giving the Pope a Cubs hat, giving him a jar of Jardinera from J.P. Graziano's, and please credit me for being able to say that on one take without tripping up. And then after that one-on-one meeting, the rest of the delegation will have an audience with the Pope. They'll walk up one by one and be able to shake hands, and that's according to Johnson's press office.
Okay, and where are you standing right now? Of course, we can hear some of the commotion in the background.
Yeah, I'm right outside the wall of Vatican City that separates the Vatican City from the rest of Rome. St. Peter's Square in front of the Basilica is very open. You can go and walk through, but then the rest of it is closed off with armed security. There's armed security guards with long guns outside of it, securing this entrance, and that's, of course, where Johnson went in. So right. I'm sitting here, the rest of the press corps, I'm looking at them. They're sitting on the street filing all of their stories, and that's what we're up to, waiting for this meeting.
Any other ideas of what Mayor Johnson will be up to in Rome? What else while he's
so
there?
After After this, we get to question him and grill him at American University. We'll all head to a press conference. And then tonight, he's doing a fireside chat with people from American University. He might do a walk along the river in Rome with reporters. We're crossing our fingers for that. And then tomorrow, he does a tour of the city with the mayor of Rome to tour an affordable housing unit. Affordable housing is a huge issue in Rome, just as it is in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the mayor may have just arrived in Rome today, Mariah, but you've been in the Eternal City for a few days now. Anything else you want to share with our listeners about what you've been observing so far?
Well, yesterday I went to the general audience of Pope Leo XIV. He does it weekly. It's a massive, massive event with thousands of people who come and fill in St. Peter's Square for a Catholic Mass with the Pope. He rides around in, I've got nothing else to call it but a Pope mobile. It's like a truck that he rides around through the Mass and waves to people and gives them blessings. And so I went to that, and there were a lot of Chicagoans there. We ran into a couple who were just on vacation from Rome, and they knew about the mayor's meeting as well. And they said, "We are, you know, overjoyed that he's doing this. We hope it leads to a strong connection between Rome and Chicago, and we hope that the mayor can get the Pope back to his hometown for a visit because they think it would be good for Chicago and tourism here." So that's definitely something that we'll be asking the mayor later, if he invited the Pope to come to Chicago.
Yes, very good question. All right, well, before I let you go, I mean, how much longer will Mayor Johnson be in town, and you?
So I believe the mayor leaves on Saturday. I leave tomorrow. And so he'll have one more day throughout the city, hopefully get some pizza, pasta, whatever his heart desires, although he is on a health kick. So I don't know if Rome is necessarily his city for eating, but that's what he'll be doing. And then I leave tomorrow morning.
All right. Well, wonderful reporting from Rome. That's Mariah Wolfel, WBEZ's city government and politics reporter. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sasha.
So, folks, you were listening along. Tell me what you heard from Mariah. What stood out to you? Sarah, we locked eyes when we heard Stacey Davis Gates is over in Rome as well, as part of that entourage.
I know. That was very surprising to me, especially because, you know, right now is heading towards the end of the legislative season in Springfield. And the CTU yesterday, they had a huge entourage go down to Springfield to try to drum up some support for progressive revenue options so that the school district could perhaps get some more money. But I guess she wasn't there because I'm pretty sure she was maybe on a plane coming and going to Rome.
Exactly.
Now it seems like, I mean, I don't know, maybe she was, and then she went straight from Springfield to the to O'Hare. But either way, that is pretty surprising. And it also shows that, you know, the closeness between Mayor Johnson and Stacey Davis Gates. I think that maybe people have wondered, you know, have they kept that connection as he's in office? And I guess the answer is maybe yes.
Cassie, what comes to mind for you?
You know, what struck me was when Mariah was talking about the 15 passenger SUVs, right, and the tinted windows and the people in them. And I know that one of the people in them, because I was looking at the story this morning on WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times, that they've started, is Phil Stefani. Mm. And what's interesting to me is Phil Stefani is a Chicago restaurateur, and he is there because he and Art Smith, who is another Chicago restaurateur and Oprah's former chef, mm-hmm, are opening a restaurant on the Vatican grounds. And it's too early to get any details. Believe me, we have tried. But this is something that I find when we're talking about the Chicago-Rome connection, the fact that it's not just the Pope, it's also going to be our food culture, mm-hmm, that's there.
I just love the fact that we're just, Chicagoans are just, you know, spilling throughout the streets. We're just like casually walking down like, hey,
right,
seeing Chicagoans in Rome. Lisa?
It would be nice to be there too, you know, I would love it. But yeah, it's surprising to hear who's there, why are they there, you know, like who got chosen? How did the mayor decide who to pick?
Everyone's got an agenda.
You know? If I knew Stacey was going, I would have advocated for myself,
right,
to go.
You
I should be
gone,
there.
Exactly.
All right, let's dig into some other stories here, Lisa. A new analysis from the University of Chicago tells us more about police response time since ShotSpotter was removed.
Yeah, I found this was fascinating this morning. So basically, to boil it down, ShotSpotter didn't do anything to really help police respond quickly in neighborhoods. The University of Chicago analysis showing that since ShotSpotter was deactivated by Mayor Brandon Johnson, the average police time has been more than 8 minutes faster. after that detection system was turned off. So, you know, I don't know. Chicago sociology professor Rob Vargas says the data that they studied show officers were sent on wild goose chases and officers deserve to have technology that works.
Perhaps the mayor was onto something when he got rid of it.
It was expensive.
Yeah. Well, sticking with you here, Lisa, Groupon, the Chicago-based digital voucher company, they've announced cuts to some, 400 jobs?
Yeah, 400 jobs globally. They're trying to improve their profitability. This coupon company says this will reduce annual costs by up to $25 million. Groupon, I haven't really thought about Groupon in a long time. I hate to say that.
Must be nice, Lisa.
It's just because I'm not buying anything.
Well, listen, I at one point was a single mom, and, you know, you got to find activities for the kids keep them quiet on a Saturday or Sunday and Groupon sure came in handy.
It did. And, you know, in 2013, Groupon had as many as 2,500 employees working here in Chicago at the headquarters, but the headcount was recently fewer than 400. So Groupon, you know, still cutting costs.
Yeah. Sarah and Cassie, you still Grouponing?
I haven't Grouponed in a long time.
I know. Me neither.
Popular in the 2010s.
It was.
I totally feel like Groupon's one of those things where you're like, it's still going.
Right. Cassie, sticking with local business, Atelier, the Michelin-starred eatery in Lincoln Square, has closed. And abruptly, it seems.
Quite abruptly. I think about a week ago, the chef there posted on Instagram that he was exiting. And then we learned this week that the restaurant itself was closing. I mean, this restaurant has quite a history in Lincoln Square. Previously, before it was Atelier, it was Elizabeth. And Elizabeth was the restaurant of Ileana Reagan, who was sort of a famed forager who created this restaurant really out of her love of foraging in the forests and really eating locally. I think that's really interesting. And so, and then it changed hands. There was a new chef. It earned a Michelin star, which was really exciting. And then it moved. It was actually in this kind of funky storefront on Western, and it moved just a little bit more proximate to Lincoln Square. And the idea was that more walk-in traffic, they actually offered more things. It wasn't just a tasting menu. This is fine dining, but can you get people in the door just more casually? I think they were really trying to have a fine dining establishment survive in the neighborhoods outside of downtown. And they didn't make it. They didn't have enough people walking in. Not enough reservations.
Yeah, inflation is it's hitting the restaurant industry really hard.
I think especially in the neighborhoods. I think people still think about, we're going to drop money. We're going to go downtown. I think that hits the tourist industry. But I think the risk we're going to see is in the neighborhoods. And you also have the pressure of rents going up. Landlord disputes. Two other restaurants that I really loved in Lincoln Square have closed in the past 2 years. And I think, you know, you talk to the Chamber of Commerce there, they're not worried. They say more restaurants are coming in. This is part of the natural churn. But I do think we're going to see changes in fine dining in the neighborhoods and see it go to more casual spots.
Sarah, onto your reporting. Recently, you talked about an 18-year-old CPS student who graduated from Mather High School after he was recently released from an immigration detention facility. So why was Ricardo Navarrete detained in the first place?
So he went, he had an ongoing immigration case along with his mother. And one day he went to immigration court with her and they were both picked up. And, you know, a lot of people are getting picked up these days when they're going to immigration court. So there's a lot of danger there. And he was there, he was in detention for about 10 weeks, more than 2 months. So it was a long time.
Yeah. What are you hearing from teachers and classmates?
Well, they're just so elated.
They're excited.
Today is graduation, and he is going to be able to make it there. And I think that that was what everybody was hoping for.
Yeah.
They were really heartbroken that he wasn't able to go to prom, and he wasn't able to do all the senior stuff, but at least he gets to walk.
Well, let's hear from one of his peers. This is Mateo.
I was screaming in class. I was like, oh, Ricardo. Like, and then he was happy. Like, his smile came back and stuff like that. But I couldn't really talk to him a lot because the teacher kind of got mad at me.
He's so cute.
He was such
a sweet young man, Mateo.
Yeah.
He said that he was there to greet Ricardo when he came driving up to his house with balloons. And they're talking about getting him a cake today. And they're just, it's so, so sweet.
Tuesday was the deadline to enter the race for Chicago's first fully elected school board. You reported 51 candidates have put themselves forward. Anybody we should know? Anybody familiar?
Well, there's all the incumbents are running for something.
Okay.
So two of the incumbents are running that represent districts now are running for president. So their seats are becoming open, but they're still running. The only person who's not running is the current CPS board president, Sean Hardin. He's just like, this is a hard job. I don't know anyone why anybody would do this. You know, it's an unpaid position. But a lot of, you know, not really known names, but people who are parents and community activists. Actually, I was surprised at how many, like, university researchers I talked to the other day who were signing up, you know, education researchers who are really interested in, you know, putting their theories into practice.
So. Yeah. Oh, wow. Cassie, this next story is for the self-proclaimed freaks, misfits, and weirdos. I'm talking about this great story from the Arts and Culture Desk this week about a beloved Chicago shop of oddities celebrating 50 years in the business. What should we know about the alley?
Well, I think that's also a shop for if you are a quintessential Chicagoan, you know the alley. It opened in 1976 at Clark and Belmont, and it was really in the stretch of shops that were really just more alternative sorts of things. You could get jewelry, you could get your leather bustier, you could get your big boots, you could get your awesome punk rock t-shirt. And eventually, the owner, Mark Thomas, saw that Belmont and that area was changing. I mean, there's now a big Target on that corner. Let's be honest. And so he moved a shop. He moved it to Avondale. And so it's right off of Rockwell near the river. It is still a punk rock destination. And it's actually adjacent to it is a big area where music, where bands practice. I think there's like 200 bands that practice in this loft. And so he has really kept to this like punk rock roots. It's still a destination. It is off the beaten path now, but he does a street festival. And so his street festival is happening a little bit later this month in that area.
Nice.
Tons of people come. I mean, it's still, this is a popular thing to do. But he does say he's in his 70s now, and he, unless he can find a successor, he is not going to be able to keep the alley going.
Interesting. Oh. Yeah. Well, Lisa, Metra has added a new line for folks who are traveling to Rock Island, Illinois.
Right, adding several daily trains to the Rock Island line, a mighty fine line, I might add.
Like some of the finest people are on the Rock Island line.
You didn't get my music reference, but that's okay. The Sun-Times says the extra trains are the first step in schedule adjustments. This was all required by a law, the Northern Illinois Transit Authority line. So they're adding during the weekday, late day trips, four more weekday trips during the end of the afternoon. And on the weekend, there will be 18 more weekend trips on the weekend. So that will be helping customers get around. Their updates start June 1st.
Okay. And what other stories are you watching?
All right. I just want to say yay for the Cubs and the White Sox. So first, the White Sox had a huge win yesterday, beating Minnesota 15-2. You love to see it. They scored in almost every inning. And a big hat tip to pitcher David Sandlin, who in his major league debut struck out retired 18 consecutive batters, which was the first time a White Sox pitcher had done that since 1920. So that was pretty notable. Wow. And then the Cubs finally snapping a 10-game losing streak, beating Pittsburgh 10-4.
Wow. Well, where does the time go? Cassie and Sarah, I'll ask you the same thing. What other stories are you following? You first, Cassie.
Well, I'm excited. Today is an auction for Tony Fitzpatrick. Tony Fitzpatrick is this quintessential Chicago artist who died last fall. And Tony was a very prolific artist. And so you see a lot of his works. There's murals at the Old Town School of Folk Music. You know, you see his works all around. But today is actually the largest auction since his death of his work. It's about 70 works that go up from Potter and Potter auctions. That live auction starts at 10 o'clock. And you're going to see things, you know, on the lower end of the spectrum. You're going to see, like, price-wise, you're going to see, like, lithographs and signed prints. On the upper end, his actual, some of his collages. He was he loved birding. He was one of the official artists of the Birding Association. And so you see a lot of birds, tattoo iconography, that kind of thing.
That's very cool. Sarah, what's on your radar?
Well, I'm watching Springfield. Are they going to come up with any more money for schools? You know, Chicago Public Schools is facing a $732 million deficit. And actually, within the next week, we are going to get word from the schools as to what positions they are going to be forced to cut because of the budget deficits. So there's a lot of tension in the air about what's going to happen there, because if there's no money, you know, it's this is a round of cuts. There's probably going to be more cuts, especially in central office and other operations. So
that May 31st deadline in Springfield is fast approaching, that's for sure.
Yeah.
WBEZ Sarah Karp, Lisa Labas, and Cassie Walker-Burke. And earlier we heard from WBEZ City Hall reporter Mariah Wolfel from Rome, where she's reporting on Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson's visit, Pope Leo XIV.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Micah Yason, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.